The headlines: two more Palestinians are killed at the hands of the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Iran's foreign minister says it is still possible to achieve an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal if the American side acts realistically. And also on our headlines, fresh clashes erupt between Azerbaijan and Armenia a day after the two neighbors reported nearly 100 deaths in their worst fighting since 2020. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Hours ago, Israeli forces killed two Palestinian men in the West Bank city of Jenin amid escalating tensions in the occupied territories. According to Israeli media reports, the two men lost their lives during an alleged firefight at the Jalma checkpoint north of Jenin. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in the city's refugee camp. Tensions remain high across the West Bank as the Israeli military has stepped up its daily raids, according to Palestinian sources. Regime forces have killed some 120 people in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. Earlier, we asked our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to tell us more about the latest deadly confrontation in Jenin. Here's her account.
Israeli military declared that the Israeli soldiers had killed two Palestinians and took their bodies. Later, Israeli media revealed that an Israeli force raided the village of Kfar Dan in Jenin, and they interrogated family members of two Palestinians, a 23-year-old Ahmed Abed and a 22-year-old Hani Subhi Abed. It seems that the two, they are cousins, and they ordered family members to go and to check the bodies of those two. I have mentioned the Israeli military continues a widespread operation, mainly in Jenin, and also they use excessive force and they use their guns in order to shoot and kill Palestinians. So it's the Israeli military story, but at the end of the day, what the Israeli soldiers are doing is an attempt to prevent Palestinians to be engaged in any form of resistance against the Israeli forces.
A senior delegation of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas that's been visiting Moscow for several days continues to discuss matters of mutual concern with senior Russian officials. In their latest meetings, Hamas representatives have held talks with the chairman of the Russian State Duma Committee on International Affairs and the chair of the Russian Federation Council Committee on Foreign Affairs. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is leading the delegation that includes members of the Political Bureau. The Palestinian side has stressed the need for maintaining a strategic relationship with Russia during this visit, which it says is being conducted at Moscow's request. The two sides have also discussed the current situation of Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as the Israeli violations. Tensions have recently escalated between Russia and Israel over the regime's support for Ukraine, as well as its repeated attacks on Syria. Well, with more on that story, we're now joined by Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, who's with us from Gaza. Ashraf, please tell us more about this Hamas delegation visit to Russia, the significance and importance of it, and also what's being discussed.
Well, but the Hamas delegation, headed by Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh, traveled to Russia on Saturday and held several meetings with the high-ranking Russian officials, including Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, and also Leonid Slutsky, the chairman of the foreign relations of the Russian Parliament or the Duma. During their meetings, the senior Hamas delegation and the Russian officials discussed mutual interests between the two parties, and they also discussed the Israeli violations against the Palestinians. Observers believe this visit is very important as it shows how the Hamas resistance movement has gained popularity, especially in the international arena, and especially with Russia, who's a major player in the international arena. The Hamas delegation and its head, Mr. Haniyeh, urged the international, the Russian, Russia to further support the Palestinians and help the Palestinians regain their rights under the ongoing Israeli brutality, whether against the Gaza Strip or against the West Bank. During the meeting with the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, Mr. Haniyeh also brought up the issue of Palestinian resources, especially in Gaza, especially the gas field off the coast of the Gaza Strip, that Israel continues to deprive Palestinians from using it for more than two decades now.
All right, thanks a lot for the information. That was Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, joining us from Gaza. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister says it's possible to achieve a final agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal if the American side acts realistically. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Nigerian counterpart, Jeffrey Onyema. Iran's top diplomat reaffirmed Tehran's commitment to continuing negotiations with the other parties to the deal known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is determined to achieve a strong and durable agreement. He expressed hope the UN nuclear agency, the IAEA, fulfills its technical duties free from politics. Iran had said earlier the IAEA chief's claim of a gap in the agency's knowledge about the Iranian nuclear program lacked legal basis. Tehran says it would fulfill its JCPOA commitments only if the deal is restored, sanctions are removed, and other parties return to their obligations under the deal. Well, fighting is still ongoing between Azerbaijani and Armenian forces despite a Russian-brokered ceasefire to stop the border clashes. Armenia's defense ministry says Azeri troops have used artillery, mortar, and small arms in their fresh attacks. According to the ministry, the situation on the border remains tense in spite of the truce that was reached on Tuesday. Tensions once again soared between the two countries on Monday night. Both sides have traded blame over the border clashes that left nearly 100 deaths. There have been several outbreaks of violence between the two neighbors since the 2020 war over control of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh, a region that is part of Azerbaijan but has an ethnic Armenian population. Well, the senior U.S. official says Washington is planning to send another shipment of weaponry to Ukraine. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the military package will be sent in a few days. He said Washington will continue to support Ukraine's armed forces. Last week, the White House approved a $675 million package in military assistance to Ukraine. The United States has already pledged about $13 billion in military aid for Ukraine since the war began in late February. Russia has frequently warned the U.S. against arming Ukraine and sharing intelligence with the country. Moscow also says the arms shipments will only prolong the conflict. Germany's economy minister says the country is at risk of falling into recession next year as inflation is growing and firms are on the verge of bankruptcy. Robert Habeck says German consumers and businesses are currently under immense pressure due to rising energy prices. He said the country is planning market reform to tackle potential threats. He was referring to a recent decision by the government to impose the levy dubbed a coincidental profit tax on energy firms. That will supposedly shield consumers from higher costs. Energy prices have been skyrocketing in Germany and other European countries due to an energy row with Russia. Europe's economy is heavily reliant on Russian energy, particularly gas. Moscow suspended gas delivery, citing repairs and blaming the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials say Russia is using energy as a weapon. A new poll in France has revealed soaring discontent with the economic impact caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia. A majority of France now prefers to protect their increasingly weak economy rather than Ukraine, but few expect Paris or Brussels to change course. Swami Mazari has more from Paris.
With record inflation already established and long-term recession looming, few could deny that Europe's sanctions war on Russia has backfired economically so far. A new poll from a top French TV news channel has found that the French have become extremely pessimistic about the conflict in Ukraine and increasingly fed up with the price they have to pay for a country which is not even a part of the European Union or the Eurozone. The poll found that almost 60% want the sanctions on Russia to stop or be reduced if they have too big an impact on the average French person's purchasing power.
Les sanctions et de façon irresponsable et anti-économique.
These sanctions are totally irresponsible from an economic and social point of view. Russia is the only one benefiting from the sanctions, and they've made incredible profits on the increase in oil prices. This is not a situation which can last, given the poor economic state of France and the Eurozone.
France is split almost 50-50 on the question of, has military and financial aid to Ukraine been effective? Almost 85% of those polled think the war will drag on for years. The poll goes against the stated positions of Brussels, Paris, and France's mainstream media moguls, but the economic difficulty of the French working class is extremely hard to suppress. There were over 100 arrests in Paris last weekend at a protest of the economic-based Yellow Vest movement. Many wonder if the French will increasingly brave well-known police and judicial repression in order to protest an unequal economy which appears certain to only worsen. After the coronavirus pause, the Yellow Vests have been marching nationwide every Saturday since their season two began in October of 2021. However, French mainstream media have essentially had a blackout on the group since June 2019. While Europe is warning that energy shortages are likely to produce a winter of frosty discontent, the new poll shows a majority of France had already grown weary of sanctions on Russia by the twilight of summer. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Following the death of Queen Elizabeth II, experts say the UK Commonwealth may soon die along with her. A trend of member states quitting the former empire bloc has gained traction in recent years, and many believe that the new king will fail to keep the Commonwealth going much longer. Robert Carter explored this theory in his latest report from Windsor.
Members of the British-led Commonwealth could amount a mass exodus of the bloc following the death of British royal Queen Elizabeth II. With Republican movements gaining ground from Australia to the Bahamas, the new King Charles III could see his royal domain shrink below the current 14 countries he currently rules over.
Barbados was the last country to leave, becoming a republic just last year. Jamaica has also expressed a strong desire to follow suit, with a referendum planned in 2025. On Monday, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda said that his nation should have a vote on whether they should keep the royal family as head of state within the next few years. Elsewhere, Australia and New Zealand have witnessed renewed calls for a public debate on the matter to decide what they should do going forward.
Founded in 1931, the Commonwealth is a collection of countries which were former dominions of the British Empire. Following the global demand for greater freedom, the Empire was forced to grant more independence to its remaining territories. The Commonwealth Charter claims the bloc works towards shared goals of prosperity, democracy, and peace. So why would so many member states be this seemingly eager to quit? Press TV asked Dr. Salman Butt for his thoughts.
I don't really think there's much Commonwealth about it. I mean, it's a bunch of countries, unfortunately, that share one thing in common, which they've been completely destroyed and, you know, and terrorized by the same kind of empire. There is this underlying kind of neo-imperialist agenda and soft power that's being, you know, still being imposed on other countries, especially so-called, you know, third world countries, which, by the way, the reason why they're the third world now is because of, unfortunately, being systematically destroyed and deindustrialized and kind of pillaged by empire, British Empire.
The new King and Queen are expected to launch a tour in 2023, visiting a number of Commonwealth nations in an attempt to combat the rise in anti-monarchy sentiment. Their performance could decide the fate of their shrinking royal realm. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro says he will retire from politics if he fails to come out victorious in next month's elections. Bolsonaro urged young people to vote carefully, warning them against the recent wave of left-wing victories in Latin America. Latest opinion polls show the incumbent Brazilian president lagging behind his main rival, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. A poll by IPEC shows Lula has extended his lead to 15%. The survey says Lula enjoys 46% of voter support against Bolsonaro's 31%. The first round of elections is scheduled for the 2nd of October. Bolsonaro has lost much of his popularity due to his contentious management of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economy. We earlier asked our correspondent, Camila Escalante, for more details on the latest opinion poll on Brazil's next president. Here's what she told us.
Well, we've seen a series of polls in recent weeks in which the candidates were largely stagnant. And one recent poll actually showed, depicted Bolsonaro as gaining a couple of points. But this poll by the IPEC, which was actually commissioned by Globo, a right-wing media network, the largest network in Brazil, showed that, in fact, former President Lula da Silva is picking up in the polls. And in their most recent poll, which was conducted between the 9th and 11th of this month and just published yesterday, we see a 16-point lead for the first round in valid votes between Lula and President Jair Bolsonaro. So this is the first time in months that this poll has shown Lula gaining ground. Also, in the second round, there's an even larger distance between the two candidates. If it were a scenario where Lula da Silva, the former president, went head-to-head with Jair Bolsonaro. In that poll, we see voter intention is 53% in support of Lula, and just 36% say they'll be supporting Bolsonaro.
That's a wrap for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former US President Donald Trump hasn't been interviewed on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News for more than 100 days, and other Republicans often get the attention that Donald Trump once received. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Fox News, Once Home to Trump, Now Often Ignores Him. It has been more than 100 days since Donald Trump was interviewed on Fox News. The network, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch and boosted Mr. Trump's ascension from real estate developer and reality television star to the White House, is now often bypassing him in favor of showcasing other Republicans. In the former president's view, according to two people who have spoken to him recently, Fox News's ignoring him is an affront far worse than running stories and commentary that he has complained are too negative. The network is effectively displacing him from his favorite spot, the center of the news cycle. On 22nd of July, as Donald Trump was rallying supporters in Arizona and teasing the possibility of running for president in 2024, saying, "We may have to do it again." Fox News chose not to show the event. The same approach it has taken for nearly all of its rallies this year. Instead, the network aired Laura Ingraham's interview with a possible rival for the 2024 Republican nomination, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. It was the first of two primetime interviews that Fox News Channel aired with Ron DeSantis in the span of 5 days. He appeared on Tucker Carlson's show shortly after talking to Laura Ingraham. When Donald Trump spoke to a gathering of conservatives in Washington this week, Fox News did not air the speech. It instead showed a few clips after he was done speaking. That same day, it did broadcast live, for 17 minutes, a speech by former Vice President Mike Pence. Donald Trump has complained recently to aides that even Sean Hannity, his friend of 20 years, doesn't seem to be paying him much attention anymore, one person who spoke to him recalled. The snubs are not coincidental, according to several people close to Rupert Murdoch's Fox Corporation, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the company's operations. This month, the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, both of them owned by Rupert Murdoch, published blistering editorials about Donald Trump's actions concerning the 6th of January 2021 riot on the Capitol. The skepticism towards Donald Trump extends to the highest levels of the company, according to two people with knowledge of the thinking of Rupert Murdoch, the chairman, and his son, Lachlan Murdoch, the chief executive. It also reflects concerns that Republicans in Washington, like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, have expressed to the Murdochs about the potential harm that Donald Trump could cause to the Republican Party's chances in the upcoming elections, especially its odds of taking control of the Senate. The Murdochs' discomfort with Donald Trump stems from his refusal to accept his election loss, according to two people familiar with those conversations, and is generally in sync with the views of Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who mostly supported the former president, but long ago said the election was settled and condemned Donald Trump's efforts to overturn it. One person familiar with the Murdochs' thinking said they remained insistent that Fox News had made the right call when its decision desk projected that Joseph R. Biden would win Arizona just after 11 p.m. on the night of the election, a move that infuriated Donald Trump and short-circuited his attempt to prematurely declare victory. This person said Lachlan Murdoch had privately described the decision desk call, which came days before other networks concluded that Donald Trump had lost the state of Arizona, as something only that Fox had the courage and science to do. Some of the people acknowledged that Fox's current approach to Mr. Trump could be temporary. If Donald Trump announces he's running for president or he's indicted, he will warrant more coverage, they said. A spokesman for Mitch McConnell declined to comment. A spokesman for the Fox Corporation also declined to comment, as did a spokeswoman for Donald Trump. The relationship between Donald Trump and the Murdoch media empire has long been complicated. An arrangement of mutual convenience and mistrust that has had sensational ups and downs since Donald Trump first talked himself onto the gossip pages of the New York Post in the 1980s. But the spat between the former president and the media baron, who has helped set the Republican Party's agenda for decades, is occurring in a much larger and more fragmented media landscape, as new personalities and platforms make it much harder for any one outlet to change the narrative. Donald Trump's allies in the corners of the conservative media that are more loyal to him, including Breitbart, Newsmax, and Talk Radio, are already seizing on the turn inside Fox News as evidence of a betrayal. Donald Trump appears willing to fight. He blasted Fox and Friends this week on his social media service, Truth Social, for being terrible and having gone to the dark side after one of his hosts had mentioned that Ron DeSantis had beat Donald Trump in two recent opinion polls of a hypothetical 2024 Republican primary contest. Then, offering no evidence, he blamed Paul Ryan, the former Republican Speaker of the House, with whom he often clashed. Paul Ryan sits on the Fox Corporation's board of directors. The New York Post was often on Mr. Trump's side in its editorials when he was president, but it occasionally went against him, like when Donald Trump refused to concede the election in 2020 and the paper's front page headlines blared, "Mr. President, stop this insanity." Donald Trump found a home on Fox News when the network's founder, Roger Ailes, gave him a weekly slot on Fox and Friends in 2011. Mr. Trump used the platform to connect with the budding Tea Party movement as he thrashed establishment Republicans like Paul Ryan and spread a lie about the authenticity of President Barack Obama's birth certificate. Initially, neither Roger Ailes nor Rupert Murdoch thought of Donald Trump as a serious presidential candidate. Roger Ailes told colleagues at the time that he thought Donald Trump was using his 2016 campaign to get a better deal with NBC, which broadcast The Apprentice, according to Insurgency, this reporter's account of Mr. Trump's rise in the GOP. And when Ivanka Trump told Rupert Murdoch over lunch in 2015 that her father intended to run for president, Rupert Murdoch reportedly did not even look up from his soup, according to The Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green. But as Mr. Trump became bigger than any one news outlet and bigger than even his own political party, he was able to turn the tables and rally his supporters against Fox News or any other outlet he felt was too critical of him. He regularly used Twitter to attack Fox personalities like Megyn Kelly, Charles Krauthammer, and Karl Rove. The network could always be critical of him in its news coverage, but now the skepticism comes through louder. In asides from news anchors, in interviews with voters, or in opinion articles for other Murdoch-owned media properties. Referring to the congressional investigation into the 6th of January attack, the Fox anchor Brett Baier said it had made Donald Trump look horrific by detailing how it had taken 187 minutes for him to be persuaded to say anything publicly about the riot. One recent segment on FoxNews.com featured interviews with Trump supporters who were overwhelmingly unenthusiastic about a possible third campaign, saying that they thought his time has passed and that he was a little too polarizing. Then they offered their thoughts on who should replace Donald Trump on the ticket. Unanimously, they named Ron DeSantis. "I spent 11 years at Fox and I know nothing pre-taped hits the Fox screen that hasn't been signed off on and sanctioned at the very top levels of management," said Eric Bolling, a former Fox News host who is now with Newsmax, "especially when it has to do with a presidential election. There can be no denying that Fox News remains Fox News. Viewers in recent weeks have seen occasionally critical coverage of Donald Trump. But unlike other news networks, Fox has chosen to air its own primetime programming rather than the hearings of the committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol." Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham dismissed the hearings as a show trial. "They are lying, and we are not going to help them do it," Tucker Carlson has said. "What we will do instead is to try to tell you the truth." The network has aired the January 6 committee hearings during the day, when far fewer viewers are tuning in. But other segments during the daytime and even evening play up violent crime in Democratic-run cities, or Joe Biden's verbal and physical stumbles. As the government announced that a key indicator of economic health declined last quarter, the headline Fox scrawled across the screen read, "Biden denies recession as U.S. enters recession." On 13th of April this year, Donald Trump called into Sean Hannity's show and ran through a list of crises he claimed would not be happening had we won this election, which we did. He hasn't been interviewed on the Fox News network ever since.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
De-dollarization is discussed more and more these days, especially since the conflict in Ukraine broke out. But this process has been ongoing for quite some time, especially when it comes to sanctioned-hit countries like Iran, Russia, and China in particular. Well, the Russian president has said that de-dollarization of the world economy is inevitable. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how feasible this approach is and whether there really is a chance for world countries to be freed from the dollar's political arm, specifically one in which the U.S. has used as a weapon. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Political analyst and journalist at the Convo Couch, Fiorella Isabel, joins us from Moscow. Also joining us is former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who joins us from Raleigh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let's take a look first and put our attention to you, Fiorella Isabel, and what the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said, that the process of de-dollarization of the global economy is inevitable. The question comes about, we've heard that before. And at this point, what about the when of this process, and how can we see that happen in layman terms, if you can?
Right. So what we're seeing is the collapse of the EU. We're seeing the collapse of the euro. We're seeing these sanctions that have consequences more on those who are imposing them than on Russia. These sanctions have essentially destroyed the European economy. And the United States, of course, doesn't seem to care very much about that. The United States defense industry and the elite of the United States are fine.
But their own country is lacking in infrastructure, and in a lot of just domestic issues are coming to a really huge issue. So Russia has other markets that they're looking at. They're looking at China, they're looking at India, they're looking at Pakistan. They're getting closer with an economic relationship to Latin America, closer to African nations as well. And so what we're seeing is this shift towards a multipolar world where the United States no longer calls the shots, where the West no longer calls the shots. And so the sanctions are actually not hurting Russia as intended. In fact, Russia has been able to bounce back rather quickly. The economy, the ruble, has been extremely high. I think the highest that any other currency has in terms of the bounce back. And the right now, with the coming winter, we're seeing that Russia will be fine when it comes to gas, when it comes to, in spite of some inflation, Russia's energy is secure. Whereas if you compare that to the EU and the UK, there's a completely different situation going on. And I think that's where we're headed.
Well, a top economic advisor to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, Ray McGovern, has said that aside from China and Russia avoiding using the dollar, is that it will minimize Washington's ability to bully other countries into following, I guess, the U.S. rules or the Western rules. And they have done that with the threat of sanctions, obviously. Do you think that that will happen, Ray McGovern?
Oh, you tricked me. Well, I think it's inevitable, not in the short run, but over the longer term. What we have is a situation where the Ukraine war and the economic sanctions have caused a tectonic shift in what the world looked like just a year ago. We have the lily-white West on the one hand, and then we have everybody else, mostly people of color, on the other hand. China, India, Russia has been so blackened that it's become a people of color. The list goes on. So you have a small minority that used to dominate things no longer able to do that. And I think as winter comes on and the Europeans realize that, you know, following U.S. diktat like lemmings can get us into a lot of trouble and even can make us freeze to death. So there's time before the winter's onslaught to work out a sensible arrangement where, in addition to lifting some of these stupid sanctions that were never going to work, response to that, allowing the Europeans to get through the winter with enough natural gas and oil so that they can deal with this stuff once spring comes. Now, the thing in the war in Ukraine, of course, is very crucial to this, but no reputable military analyst, and I used to be one of them, in my day when I served as an Army intelligence officer, no responsible person will predict that Ukraine will win this war. What's in store is protracted grief for both sides, mm-hmm. as long as NATO goads the Ukrainians on. And as my co-guest just said, the U.S. doesn't seem to care much about that, nor does the U.S. seem to care much about being warm during the wintertime.
Sure.
Nor does the West seem to care about the possibility of a new Chernobyl right there in Zaporozhye in the middle of Ukraine. Don't the Western politicians realize what that could mean? And how the U.S. would accept that blithely with Victoria Nuland in Kiev saying,
indeed.
Yeah, keep shelling Zaporozhye.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned there, Fiorella Isabel, is about Russian energy resources, in particular, obviously, gas and oil being at the top of that list. Now, here's what's interesting about how Ray McGovern says the West doesn't seem to realize or doesn't seem to care, I think is how he worded that. Why doesn't the West care when you look at the countries like Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and China, where cumulatively we're talking about 40% of the world's energy in the hands of these countries. Shouldn't the U.S. and the West care about how this divergence from the dollar or de-dollarization, as we have stated, were these countries, which they are moving away from it, would affect the standing of the dollar and hence all the repercussions from that in terms of how it would impact the U.S. economy? Don't they realize that that's what's going to happen?
Well, so there's a couple of things here. That's been the talk. Why does the United States and the West not seem to care? I think Germans seem to care, right? They're out there protesting. People in the Czech Republic have been protesting against NATO and against these sanctions on Russia because they know it's hurting their economy. I think that the working people care, but the people in power are in some ways benefiting from this. The U.S. defense industry has skyrocketed. They're making a literal killing off of this. And so the United States seems to be bullying the EU into imposing these sanctions on Russia against to their own detriment, essentially. And so what's been the talk lately is came from this report from Rand Corporation that basically outlined that the United States was pushing to destroy the German economy, because let's remember that Germany is extremely vulnerable to these sanctions because they depend largely on cheap gas from Russia. And so this is a suicidal mission for Germany. And in that report, it basically said, well, if we, in order to continue this sort of political ploy, then Germany would have to impose sanctions on Russia. And of course, it will sink its economy. And then to a greater extent, it will affect the economy of the EU. But this is a way to eliminate one of its competitors. Now, it's interesting because Germany and you know, nations in the EU, particularly obviously the NATO nations, are huge allies of the West. So it seems to me, and this is what so many are analyzing right now, is that this is a sort of controlled demolition of the economy to achieve a political purpose. And they do not care because the people pushing this sort of thing are still making out with a lot of money. So indeed, that's essentially what's being talked about right now, because otherwise it doesn't really make any logical sense that they would be pushing this to their own detriment.
Well, we need to talk about this a little bit more, even though it may be going off the subject somewhat, Ray McGovern, but to expand more about what our guest there, Fiorella Isabel, said. I'm looking at a headline of which it should really open the eyes of many, and that's how energy traders are making a killing exporting U.S. natural gas, $200 million for each single shipment, of which basically the sale of U.S. gas, liquefied natural gas, has gone up to 60%, increased, that is, to 60%, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. So we can see that being one of the few ways that the U.S. is profiting from this war. It seems like the U.S. is actually after this particular way of profiting off the war, the gas issue, energy, and of course the military sales.
Well, I appreciate Fiorella's analysis of this, and she could well be right. What I have to hearken back to is what I call the recklessness and the fecklessness of our foreign policy leaders. Now, I refer specifically to Blinken and his counterpart in Germany, Baerbock. They don't seem to know which end is up. They are very poorly advising the German government and the German people. And you know, it seems to me that this, where money is always important, whether the U.S. is doing this deliberately and Baerbock is just too dumb to realize it, to tank the German economy, that presumes an imagination and a competence that I don't think exists in Washington or with Baerbock. Now, when I said before, I hope I didn't say the West doesn't care much about the effects of the sanctions. I tried to say the U.S. doesn't, because we're kind of immune. We're going to be warm this winter. And if the new Chernobyl, if Zaporizhzhia blows because of shelling by the Ukrainians, the U.S. will be sitting pretty. There'll be a big problem in Europe, not just in Ukraine, but this helps me to understand why someone like Victoria Nuland, the Deputy Secretary of State, can go to Kiev, chutzpah personified. She's the one that caused the coup in Kiev on February 22nd, 2014. She goes back to Kiev, and next thing you know, we have a big, very big offensive, and they're still shelling Zaporozhye. UN comes in, and this is a teaching point here. Can you depend on the UN? I'm sorry. You can't depend on the IAEA. Rafael Grossi goes down there, and the shelling comes in, and he can't figure out which direction it's coming from. Give me a break. He says, we can't judge which direction it's coming from. We thank the Russians for protecting us from these projectiles, but we have to do something about this, but we don't know who's doing the shelling. Come on, give me a break. Now, my point is simply this. It used to be we could depend on the IAEA. Back 20 years ago, when Bush and Cheney wanted to make war on Iraq, I remember El Baradei, the head of the IAEA, saying very solemnly before the UN Security Council, the reports of these yellow cake uranium from Africa are not confirmed, are not, what was the word he used? Not authentic. In other words, they were made up. So since El Baradei retired, there have been a succession of people in charge of the IAEA who passed muster in Washington. Amano is another one, his direct successor. Sure. He thanked. We have the cable in which he thanked the Americans for putting him in office, and he asked for new money for to put new drapes in his office. That's a bit. We got that from WikiLeaks. So The problem is, where can the Russians turn to get a fair reading on what's going on at this critical place, the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe? They can't turn anywhere to get an unvarnished view of from which direction the shelling is coming.
Well, to go back to what we were talking about, the whole notion of de-dollarization here, Fiona Isabel, what we are looking at to have speeded this up in the context of the Ukraine conflict is when the U.S. and the West in particular, or cumulatively, froze Russia's roughly $640 billion of their assets in the foreign currency reserves due to the U.S. sanctions. That made countries around the world basically wake up. It was a wake-up call because they said, well, if we don't follow U.S. foreign policy, we could be next. Do you think then, and we have Saudi Arabia that actually began thinking about selling its oil based on the yuan. Israel even, for the first time, added China's yuan to its currency in a reshuffle that's not happened in a decade. So are we looking at countries then de-dollarizing because of that and therefore the dollar to take a hit from it?
I think the dollar is already taking a hit in those terms, right? I don't think I agree with Ray McGovern. I don't think it's going to happen right away. I think it's on its way to happening. I think it will allow for a more level playing field. And the reason I think these countries are doing that is because less of an ideological reason. I think for the most part, it's more of where they see the wind blowing, right? Like there is an economic shift right now that like never before. And Russia standing up to the expansion of NATO and Russia bouncing back and being extremely just resilient with how they've done this with, you know, the exit of, say, like these corporations like Starbucks, McDonald's. They've reinvented these sort of corporations into a Russian-based type of company where people can still keep their jobs. And that sort of resilience has resonated with many people who have found that, hey, we have all been under the boot of the U.S. empire. So now we have these opportunities to maybe perhaps build our relationships with areas that we really haven't been looking at, which is why you've been seeing, you know, Russia go in there. You saw Lavrov be received with open arms in Africa, where, of course, they talked about the USSR helping to decolonize several of these nations, whereas Blinken was not received that warmly at all. And then, of course, you see the United States poking the dragon with China as well, and via Taiwan with Pelosi's visit. So you see this sort of the economics is following the actions of militarily of the United States, NATO, and the West and Russia closer together, are pushing Iran closer to that relationship, are pushing African nations closer to dealing with their neighbors in the East and Latin America, of course. They're pushing all these nations together that have one thing in common, and that is the years and decades of being under the U.S. hegemony, right? And so they're looking for ways to no longer go back to that. And it's, again, more economic-based and ideological. So I do think we're heading in that direction where the dollar will no longer be the... But I think that's going to be more so on China rather than Russia. I do think that, like I said, it's going to be multiple choices. And, of course, Russia is looking to the East or looking to Africa. They don't necessarily... United States anymore. And they're making that very clear by refusing these price caps on the gas, right? And saying, sure, we're not going to do that at all.
Well, we're going to talk about other countries, in particular China, in the context of BRICS. But before we get to that, because our guest Ray McGovern there is in the U.S., Ray McGovern, economically and somewhat technically speaking, the dollar crisis scenario, based on the definition of it, is said that would cause a sudden crisis for the dollar is when there's the dual threat of high inflation and high debt. Now, the U.S. is plagued by those two factors, isn't it? If I'm incorrect, please let me know. That's a scenario where rising consumer prices force the Fed to raise the interest rates, something that it has done. Are we looking at these two, the debt and the inflation, causing the crisis, or has it done it already?
Well, it's on its way. It's well on its way. The question is whether policymakers in Washington have been so infected with this notion that the U.S. is exceptional that it continued to act the way it has been acting. That's what I call feckless. It's also very reckless, because if they don't realize which end is up here, people trading in rubles now, and it's inevitable what's going to happen with the debt as it is and the balance of payments and everything else. The economic situation is awful. The military situation, however, is something that will have an effect on all this. And when President Putin and President Xi meet in Samarkand just 2 days from now, there will be very important decisions made as to how much support President Xi is willing to give to Putin as Putin reacts to the recent reversals in Ukraine. I fear the worst. I fear escalation untrammeled. And one of the big factors, of course, is that Biden cannot appear to be weak as the midterm elections grow near, and that's just 2 months from now.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. We'll be looking forward to that meeting. So coming down to the wire here in terms of our time, looking at what you said, Fiorella Isabel, about China, I'd like to put that into the context of this BRICS summit that took place, the 14th one, where there was an announcement made by the Russian President Vladimir Putin about the intention to develop a new international reserve currency. Now, that's something that obviously the BRICS countries have entertained, and Brazil actually took it a step further in a sense in its part of the world, where with the presidential candidate at this point, Luiz Inácio da Silva, to have announced a regional currency for those countries there. This idea of regional currency and to trade with currencies that is not the dollar, is that going to further push the whole de-dollarization notion into high gear?
Yeah, so what we're seeing particularly with BRICS countries, right, are once again countries that have been very in a situation where they've been completely vulnerable and completely dependent in some ways on the West. And there is a push, as you can see, based on the recent elections that have been happening in Latin America, towards a sovereignty, towards exerting their own sovereignty away from the West, recuperating some of the identity. We saw this with the election of Gustavo Petro in Colombia. We've seen this in Bolivia. We've seen this in Honduras, Nicaragua, Cuba. A lot of these countries are huge allies, including Venezuela, of course, with Russia and also Iran. And so what we're seeing is this push in these BRICS countries and these countries that want to be a part of BRICS as well, that they want to have their own dependency and they want to expand not just with China and Russia, but with their own neighbors. In Latin America, there's like a reemergence of the Bolivarian sentiment from Simon Bolivar, where you know, there was this talk of liberation and democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that that definitely is playing a role ideologically, but also economically. It's a lot easier to make connections with your neighbors. And also, of course, when China offers a more equitable economic relationship, they're going to take it.
Thank you so much for that. We're fresh out of time. Fiorella Isabel, political analyst and journalist at the Convo Couch. Thank you. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Thank you so much from Raleigh. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards patience and fortitude. The one who has eloquently said, "Be aware that all good works bear praise, and they bear commendation and bring about a good reward." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues.
Every clean soul.
Imam al-Husayn's first speech on the day of Ashura, O servants of Allah, fear Allah and be wary of the worldly life. For if the world had been eternal, or anybody had been destined to live,